And obviously, when it comes to Pesach, the Seder, tons of customs, tons of ideas. People like to share. People like to think about whether it's your, a grandparent's minhag or a rabbi's idea from past years that you always find meaningful. Everyone has their ideas, and I want to put my hat in the ring. I want to add something. Maybe there's something that I can tell you which is meaningful to you. Maybe there's some things that I'll tell you that you already know. Hopefully everyone can have in their own way, especially this year, in their own personal way, a meaningful Seder. So here we go. I don't know if anyone has ever heard an idea based on the Simanim, not based on the actual words of the Haggadah yet. But you'll notice one interesting letter in the Simanim. The Simanim typically just tell you what exactly the point of the Seder is, right? So you have Kadesh, you have Orchat, Yirachat, right? You have all the different things that you have to get through. But interestingly enough, even though it's a list, we don't have any real grammar in the list, meaning it doesn't seem like a real list, because typically if you would have a list, you'd have commas, and then at the end you'd have, Hallel v'nirtza, right? You put a vav at the end. There are no vavs, there are no words and that are connecting anything, except for one. There's one exception to this rule. It doesn't say Kadesh Rachatz. It says Kadesh Orchatz. As we know, Orchatz is the same as Rachtza. It's the same thing. You're washing your hands. One is with a bracha, one is without a bracha. But why is there a vav in front of Orchatz? Why? It should be Kadesh Rachatz, Magid Rachtza. So the simple understanding, and people might or might not appreciate this depending on your personality, the simple understanding is that it's meant to rhyme, right? Kadesh Orchatz, it's meant to rhyme with Yachatz later, right? So in order to make it rhyme, so Orchatz makes it rhyme better, the rhythm flows better. But there is a possible deeper understanding that we can provide from Rav Avram Shor. And this is obviously not to be taken as the literal or simple understanding, but it is to be taken as a level, a depth of understanding. And we know that there is another time that we have a word rachatz, which is not Hebrew, but which we have in our liturgy. Does anyone know where do we find the word rachatz in our liturgy when it's not found? Here's a good, davening find. Where do we find the word rachatz in our davening when it doesn't mean to wash? Anyone know? Right? So if anyone wants to chime in, they can, but something tells me you're not getting it. I don't know. I see a smile on David Barth's face, but I don't know if that means he knows it or no. No? So we have a song that we all sing together. And it goes, Be'ana Rachitz. What does it mean, Rachitz? Be'ana Rachitz. In God, I trust. Rachitz. In Aramaic, the word rachitz means to trust. So if Avram Shor says, on a deeper level, we are saying Kadesh Orchatz, that on the one hand, we're making Kiddush. It's true, we're making Kiddush. But on the other hand, we have to make sure, specifically on this night, that our Kiddush is a Kiddush with trust in Hashem. It's a Kiddush where we're going to the Seder, we're talking about Yetzias Mitzrayim, we're believing in Hashem that He can do unbelievable things. So not only are we being Mekadesh, and in every single Kiddush we ever say, we always mention Yetzias Mitzrayim. Every single time, if you look at, we talked about this on Rosh Hashanah, if you remember. That is from Esther, that is from when we take out the Torah. We say Brich Shemei, right? That paragraph at the end where we start Bei Anarachitz. So every single, we talked about this Rosh Hashanah, every single Kiddush we ever make, we always say Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim. And we talked about then that by Sukkos it makes sense because outside of Mitzrayim we sat in Sukkos, and by Shavuos it makes sense because that was also after Mitzrayim. And we talked then about why is it on Rosh Hashanah we have Kiddush, which is Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim. Rosh Hashanah has nothing to do with Mitzrayim. But either way, on this night we do have Kiddush again. Just like every holiday, we say the word Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim. However, tonight the kiddush that we make is a particular kiddush which was instilled at the moment of Yetzias Mitzrayim with a special bitachon, a special trust in Hashem. So therefore, when we say Kadesh or Chatz, what we're saying is not only we're making kiddush, but we're making a kiddush which is with rechitza, which is with a trust in Hashem. Just like we say at Brit Shemei Be'ana Rechitz, so to say Kadesh or Chatz, that kiddush is done with a certain belief, a certain faith, and a certain security that Hashem is going to take care of us. So that's number one, a drasha on the simanim. Maybe that's a first for some of you, Kadesh or Chatz, that our kiddush should be with trust in Hashem, specifically on the Seder night. So now we have Kadesh. Let's actually go into the Agada. So what is Kadesh? So we've talked about this in a number of different ways, especially in the women's class. Last week, I think we talked about it briefly, because we were talking about Yosef, that's right. And we also talked about it on the second day of Rosh Hashanah between Mincha and Maariv. We talked about this idea very slightly. I might have mentioned it, but I probably said something along the lines that we'll save that for Pesach. So now it's Pesach, so let's talk about it. The Netziv asked the question, I also spoke about this briefly at Farber, when they asked me to give a Shabbat Shuvah Drasha during the week. So the Netziv asks a question implicitly. He says, when it comes to the end of Shmos, all the Jewish people believed in Hashem. When it came to the beginning, however, of Va'era, so it says V'lo Yaminu Hashem. It says V'lo Shamu Moshe Mikol Tzurach Me'Avad Kasha. They didn't listen to Moshe because they were working too hard. So what does that mean? So the Netziv tells us that you have to look back at the message, the difference of the messages between the end of Shmos, where they say they believed in Hashem, Vayaminu Vayamein Ha'am Vayikdu Vayishtachavu, that they believed in Hashem, they bowed down, they were all in, and at the end of at the beginning of Vayera, all of a sudden they don't believe. So one answer we've talked about before is that there was an extra dose of avoda. There was an extra dose of servitude that everybody had to do because Moshe Rabbeinu was trying to convince Paro. And in response, Paro says, I'm going to make the work harder. So maybe that's the difference between the two. Says in the Siv, no, the difference between the two is the message that was given. The first time around, when the Jewish people believed in Hashem, it was simply the message was, Hashem is going to save you. Hashem is going to take you out of Egypt. He's heard your cries. You're going to be freed. That one, the Jewish people are all in. They're believing in it completely. However, the second time around, in Va'era, when Hashem says to Moshe to give them the Dalad Lashonos Haga'ula, the four verbs, the four stages of the redemption, which we talked about last week in the women's class, when he says that, he adds one element to it that was not part of the first message. As the Netziv explains, we have the four Lashonos Haga'ula, which we know are representative of those four cups, represented by those four cups on Pesach. We have the Hotzeti. Hashem's going to take you out. Gung-ho for that. V'Yitzalti, He's going to save you. Gung-ho for that. Let's do it. Let's get out of here. V'Ga'alti, He's going to redeem you. Yes, let's get out of Egypt. But then the last one, V'Lakachti. What does V'Lakachti mean? V'Lakachti li la'am. Hashem says, I'm going to take you as a nation. And the Jewish people pump the brakes. Say, what a second. Last week when we read Shmos, you told us you were going to take us out of Egypt. In the first three cups, the first three of the four cups, we say, Hashem's going to save us. We're all on board for being saved. We're all on board for getting out of Egypt. But what's V'lakachti? V'lakachti li la'am. You're going to take me out of serving in Paro so that I can serve somebody else. What do I need that for? Why do I need that? And therefore, says in the Tziv, the four cups are not only representative of our freedom from Egypt, but it's also representative of our commitment to Hashem. It's our commitment in response to that freedom. We talked about in Rosh Hashanah the difference between Yitzchak's response and Yishmael's response to Hashem's salvation. We talked about it in terms of L'David Hashem, Ki Avi Vimi Yezavuni V'Hashem Yasfinu, Hashem gathers me up, what's my response? We said the response has to be, Horeini Hashem Darkecha, Hashem show me your ways. And in a similar sense, we're saying in the Dalet Kosos, we're saying not only the first three, it's not good enough to be the first three. But it has to be number four too. And this brings us to a greater idea about the name Pesach, which is not really relevant to this stage in the Seder, but we can still mention it now because it's Pesach. Why do we call this holiday Pesach? It's a very strange name, right? In the way that Rabbi David Foreman, you know, presents it, if I would get the greatest minds, if we got our whole congregation together, and we said, guys, we have to come up with a title for the movie about Yetzias Mitzrayim. We're making a movie. We're going to go through all the stages. What are we going to call the movie? So if we had to sort of pinpoint the most important aspect, the greatest of all miracles of Hashem during the Yetzias Mitzrayim process, what would we pick? Maybe Makas Bechoros. Not a very nice name for a movie, so maybe we wouldn't do that. Maybe Kriyas Yamsuf. He splits the sea. What a monumental occasion, a monumental event. Maybe the signs that he gave to Paro, something monumental. What is the name that we choose for our holiday? Pesach. What is Pesach? Pesach was the moment where Hashem didn't do anything. It's mamash the time where he just passed over us. Right? Why of all things do we name our holiday over the one thing where Hashem doesn't do something? You want to say he's killing the firstborn, so call it that. But why do we call the name of the holiday Pesach when that's the one thing Hashem is clearly not doing anything for? Why do we call it Pesach? That doesn't make any sense. Perhaps we can suggest, based on the same idea from the Netziv, that the purpose of Pesach, the purpose of the Dalakosos, is not simply to be taken out of Egypt. It's not simply that we are passive and Hashem is doing everything for us. But it's because the one time, the only time in the entire Pesach story that we explicitly do something ourselves was the Karban Pesach. The name that we give to the holiday of Pesach is the one thing Hashem does which is predicated first by an action from us. The only thing, you can look at all the Makos, you can look at all Kriyas Yamsuf, you have Nachshon Ben Aminadav, which is a little bit predicated by an action of an individual. But everything Hashem does, He does it as a gift. He does it out of His own kindness, out of His commitment to the Jewish people, His commitment, His promise He made to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. The one thing that we did ourselves, the one thing that Hashem does only in response to what we do, is the Pesach. Is the fact that he goes over the houses and doesn't enter ours because of the blood. So when we talk about the Dalal Kosos, it's the same idea. The first three are things that Hashem did for us. But the fourth one, V'lakachti li la'am, the fourth coast, the fourth cup, is what we do for Hashem. And that's why the holiday is called Pesach, and it's not called Kriyas Yamsuf, or it's not just called God's redemption. Okay, moving on to Karpas, and this is definitely a chazara from last week, but those who were not here for the women's class maybe would appreciate it also, and that is that Karpas, according to some, is, or at least according to a concept by Rabbi J.J. Schachter, is representative of something which happens at the beginning of the Pesach story. We talked about this last week, obviously, for those who were here, but it's interesting to note that the entire Pesach, the whole Haggadah, never mentions how we got down to Egypt. Well, it does talk about, we'll talk about it in a little bit, maybe a little bit by Lavan. But what happened that brought the Jewish people down? The whole story of Yosef. But yet we never talk about Yosef in the entire Haggadah. There are many references to Yosef that are hidden, which we talked about last week. One of them is Karpas. If you look at the Pasuk, Rashi tells us that the word Ketonet HaPasim, the word Pas, is part of the word Karpas. Why is Rashi talking about the Seder night during his commentary of Yosef, of the Ketonet HaPasim? Well, the truth is he's not. He's talking about the only other time in Tanakh where the word Karpas is mentioned. Anyone know about that one? Women who are not here. David?
Yes. David. Isn't it in Esther?
In Esther, yes. Chel Karpasu Techeles. That Achashverosh's feast had many different materials. One of the materials was this fine wool, which was called Karpas. And the Gemara tells us it's actually a conjugation of two words, kar, which is pillows, and pas, which is wool. So Rashi tells us that the ketonet ha-pasim of Yosef was actually a woolen tunic because of the word pasim, wool. So what does that have to do with the Seder? What does that have to do with karpas in our sense? So we said last week that some people explain that karpas is dipped not in salt water. According to the Rambam, it's supposed to be dipped in charoses. The charoses, everyone's got their own recipe for charoses, so you know what I'm talking about just when I say the word. The charoses, according to the Yerushalmi, is supposed to, according to one opinion in the Yerushalmi, is supposed to be liquidy, not thick. Some people have thick, some have more liquid, some loose. So why is it supposed to be liquidy? Because the charoses is supposed to represent the blood of the Jews in Egypt. So what do we have? We have karpas, according to Rashi, which represents the Knot HaPasim. We have the Rambam, who says it's supposed to be dipped in the charoses. You have the Yerushalmi, this is supposed to be in blood. What are we saying when we dip charoses, when we dip the karpas into the charoses, at least in its theoretical sense, according to the Rambam? What we're saying is that before we get to Egypt, we have to recognize what got us there. It was when the brothers put that tunic in the blood and framed Yosef as being murdered by the animals. And that's what we first start the Seder with, the dipping of the Ketonat HaPasim in the blood of the goat. Okay, moving on to Manishtana. By the way, it hurts me to not talk about other more in-depth concepts that I have prepared, but we don't have time, and people don't have the attention spans, and people don't have necessarily the wherewithal to say them over at their Seder, but something that I'm just going to give over ideas that people can connect to, people find meaningful, and can say over without having their Seder go for hours on end, like mine sometimes do. Okay, Manishtana. Manishtana is fascinating to me, not because of how the children can sing it so well and how people have different customs of saying it in different languages, but really because Manishtana is one question. We often call it the four questions, but the only question we ever ask in the Manishtana is Manishtana halayla hazeh mikol halelos. What's the difference tonight from all other nights? And then we list four details that promote that question, that bolster that question. We have this which is different, that which is different, this is different, that which is different. Fine. I'm very tempted to give over some other things, but we're just going to stick to this. What is the purpose of asking questions? As we know, we have the children later on, the four sons later on that we're going to talk about more questions. And I think in some ways, especially at the beginning of the Seder, right after we say Halach Ma'anya, which by the way, you might have an idea from my Shabbos HaGadol Drasha that you might have read. You have an idea there from Halach Ma'anya, a few different ideas there. Halach Ma'anya, as we say, is the poor man's bread, right? The poor man's bread that they ate in Egypt, it represents the poverty, the difficulty of the Jewish people in Egypt. Manishtana, I believe, in one sense, could be also a reference to that same shibud. Because why is it important to have questions? Why is it important to have questions? I believe because when you ask a question, you create a certain thirst, you create a certain shibud, a certain subjugation. There's a reason why every good book, every good movie, every good plot has a problem. You never have a movie which is just all the good stuff, right? You always have to start with a problem. Every drasha has a problem. Why do they do that? Why do you have problems? Why do you have questions? Because in order to actually appreciate answers, and in order to really want the answer, you have to first have that need for the answer. You have that lacking, you have that thirst. The Pachad Yitzchak Rav Yitzchak Huttner, that he once said that you don't teach your students until their tongues are white. Interesting, the tongues are white. What does that mean? You're so hungry and thirsty for the answer that you want to you want the answer so bad that you're so hungry for it. I mean, there's a certain shibud. There's a certain not slavery per se, but a subjugation or a need. That a person is enslaved to know, I need to know the answer, right? And I think that's why there's a focus on questions during the Seder night. What's interesting about that, in terms of that concept, is as opposed to the four sons, the Manishtana is a question or four questions which have no answer. Now, there are some drushas that say that the stuff after the Manishtana is a reference back to answering the Manishtana, but in its explicit form, there's no answer to the Manishtana. Why don't we answer the Manishtana? And I think it's because the purpose of the Manishtana is to create that struggle. It's to create that semi-slavery where we all feel like we need something to be redeemed. That's why the Manish Tana is only questions. Moving on to Avadim Hayinu. So Avadim Hayinu is also a reference to our Shibud, obviously. But what's interesting is, if you notice carefully, if you look carefully at the actual words, so you'll see that the words Avadim Hayinu start off to tell us that we were slaves. And after that, it tells us, what does it say? V'ilu... That's an interesting word, because it should say, why does it change to say Avadim Hayinu, we were slaves, and now it says not that we were slaves, but we would be subjugated to Paro in Egypt? So the Sfas Emes has a fascinating idea. First of all, does that really make sense? Does it really make sense that the Jewish people over 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, oh, I don't know, 2,500 years ago, were subjugated to Egypt? They were slaves in Egypt. What, does it really make sense that we would still be slaves in Egypt? I mean, it's possible, but odds are at some point the Egyptian, you know, monarchy would be overthrown. Somebody else would save us. Some other things would have happened that would have made us, you know, leave Egypt. So says the Sfas Emes, the point of this paragraph is not to say that if we wouldn't have gotten out then, we wouldn't have gotten out ever. But it's rather to say that it was specifically the way that we got out. V'ilu lo hotzi HaKadosh Baruch Hu asav oseinu mimitzrayim. It doesn't say that v'ilu lo yatzanu mimitzrayim. It doesn't say if we wouldn't have left Egypt. It says that if it wasn't Hashem that took us out of Egypt. Says the Sfas Emes, if it wasn't Hashem that took us out of Egypt, but rather it was some other powerful emperor or some other nation, if it was somebody else that got us out of Egypt, Hare anu uvanenu bnei banenu mishubadim hayinu leparo b'mitzrayim, we would still be subjugated to some kind of paro, to some kind of emperor in some kind of Mitzrayim. Says Hashem, it's not supposed to be taken literally, but what it means is it was only once Hashem took us out. It was only once we recognized Hashem's power in the world that we were truly free. Because as long as it was somebody else or some other power, quote-unquote, we would have still been subjugated in some aspect. And that's why Avadim Hayinu is telling us that we are Meshubadim if it wasn't for Hashem. Hashem is the one that set us free, because it was Hashem's own power that allowed us that perspective. Moving on to the next phrase, Va'afilu kulanu chachamim. Va'afilu kulanu chachamim is perhaps, to me, one of the most important aspects of the Seder, because the overarching purpose of the Seder is oftentimes lost in trying to understand different aspects of Mitzrayim. And I think that the perspective of trying to understand is a misleading one. Because as this phrase even says, even if we were all brilliant, we could all understand the most in-depth concepts. That's not the purpose of the Seder. The purpose of the Seder is to feel Mitzrayim, not to know Mitzrayim. We do this every single year. We go through the Haggadah every single year. The purpose of the Seder is not to know what happened in Egypt. It's to feel what happened in Egypt. And that's why if you look at the phrasing in this word, even if we were all brilliant, we were all very old, wise men, women, children, teenagers, doesn't matter who, if we all knew, kulanu yodim es haTorah, we all know the Torah, even if we know everything, mitzvah aleinu, not ladat yitzyed Mitzrayim, but rather lisaper, B'yitzias Mitzrayim. What is a sipur? What's the difference between a sipur and a zecher? Right, as we say in Kiddush, zecher l'yitzias Mitzrayim. To remember Egypt. This is not what we're doing tonight. Tonight is not zecher l'yitzias Mitzrayim. It's sipur yitzias Mitzrayim. Sipur means, Esther just wrote, it's experiential. But I would go a step further that when we tell a story, stories are emotional. Stories are not textbooks. Stories are not encyclopedias. We're not going through, you know, how exactly every detail of what exactly happened. We're not going through the commentaries of the psukim. What we go through interpretations of the psukim, but we're not going through trying to understand the ins and outs of how everything. We're not trying to answer Rabbi Katz's kashas on Yetzias Mitzrayim. What we're doing is trying to feel Yetzias Mitzrayim, and therefore we pull at the heartstrings. We tell a sipur. We tell a story which can make us relate on an experiential level to what exactly happened in Egypt. And that's why it doesn't matter how brilliant you are, no matter how much knowledge you have, even if yodim, even if we know, it's still a mitzvah lesaper. It's still a mitzvah to say a story so that you can feel it and not just know it. Other interesting nuances that I'm not going to talk about. And then we have the story of Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah, Rabbi Kiva, Rabbi Tarfon, Shai Mesubim Bnei Brak. Fascinating academic investigations into how exactly this happened. Did this really happen? Why are they all going to Bnei Brak to talk about the Seder? Was there some kind of persecution there? Very interesting stuff. I think Rav Sachs has a fascinating thing in that Haggadah that we gave out. Everyone can look at that. But we're not really going to talk about this. But it's obviously in reference to what we just said, that it's a mitzvah even for the Chachamim to talk about it. Interesting question. How could they have stayed up all night? Isn't that going to make them tired? What about Onei Yontif? What about enjoying the holiday? They're going to be tired for the rest of the holiday. So for them, that was their enjoyment, right? For them, the way that you enjoy the holiday is to learn Torah. How about we all get there? I'm Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Harayani Kven Shim Shana. Fascinating statements from Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, this whole story. What does this have to do with Egypt? We talked about this story in the Gemara in Brachos for Daf Yomi class. But what's interesting is the drasha from Ben Zoma. There's a much longer shtickel to talk about who Ben Zoma was and why that's important here in terms of Kabbalah Brios. But we won't get into that either. But obviously this drasha is talking about Yetzias Mitzrayim. What exactly both drashas have to do with it? So much to talk about, I can't get into it. But, Baruch HaMakom Baruch Hu. We see this Baruch HaMakom paragraph almost as, and this is the machlokas between what kind of text you have in your Haggadah. Some texts have this as one whole paragraph, some texts have it as a separate paragraph from the next thing. But assuming that it's a paragraph which is an introduction to the four sons, so the question is why? So if you'll notice the word that we talked about last night in our Mishle class, Baruch HaMakom, Baruch HaMakom Baruch Hu. Why does the word specifically here talk about HaMakom? What is the word HaMakom? It's a reference to Hashem. Hashem is in the place. What is the place? So it's I think, an introduction to the four sons. Because oftentimes we can think, the Chacham is this, the Rasha is that, and we'll get into them exactly, what exactly they represent in a second. But at the base level, before we talk about the different kinds of people that there are at the Seder, we have to know that no matter where you are, no matter what makom you are, Baruch HaMakom, that place that you are, you can find Hashem. Doesn't matter where you are in life. And we say in Kedusha every single day, those who are privy to it. So we say, Baruch Kavod Hashem Mimkomo. Blessed is the honor of God from His place. What does that mean, from His place? In heaven? Is he not blessed in earth? So the whole point, I think, of that pasuk is to tell us that Baruch Hashem, Baruch Kvod Hashem Mimkomo, not from where Hashem is, but where you are. Baruch Hashem Mimkomo, the place that you are, you can still feel comfortable blessing Hashem no matter what stage of Judaism you're at, no matter how much you know, how much you do. You should always feel comfortable that you have a stake in blessing Hashem. Baruch HaMakom Baruch Hu. And that's what's the introduction for the four sons. So what I find interesting, I've heard other drushas based on this word, but the introduction, if that wasn't the introduction to the four sons, so the next word, keneged, arbavanim, is the introduction to the four sons. What does the word keneged mean? Keneged typically means in opposition to, or opposite from. It could also mean paralleling or in reference to. But the word keneged, in its first use, I think, in the Torah, we find it where? Women? Eselo ezer kenegdo. Right? That Hashem is going to make for Adam HaRishon, he's going to make him an ezer opposite him. What does it mean, an ezer opposite him? You know, hopefully all the, I remember a bunch of years ago, There's a rabbi. Oh, what's his name? Rav Shlomo Aviner. Rav Shlomo Aviner was once. He has this very interesting ongoing texting Shaul Tshuvos, questions and answers that people give him. And one person I remember asked, "Do I have to help my wife clean for Pesach?" That was the question. So Rabbi Aviner responded, "You do not have to help your wife clean for Pesach, and she does not have to help you. You have to do it together. This is not the woman's job that the man helps. It's not the man's job that the woman helps. You're both doing it 100%. It's not 50%, 50%. It's 100%, 100%. We should do it together." So in light of that, so what does the pasuk mean? Aselo ezer kenegdo. I've made him a helper, which is opposite him. What does that mean? A helper, which is opposite him. So the Kli Yakar says over there that you have to understand it in the context of the pasuk right beforehand. Lo tov hayos ha'adam levado. It's not good for man to be alone. What does it mean it's not good for man to be alone? If Hashem wanted to say that it's bad for man to be alone, so Hashem knows how to say that. He knows how to say ra la'adam. It's bad, right? And he even uses the word ra earlier or later in the parsha. It's bad for man to be alone. So why does he use the word lo tov? So the Kli Yakar says, the reason he says lo tov is that whenever you're just by yourself, all you're doing is to yourself. So then you're alone. You have nobody to work with. You have nobody you have to compromise with. You have nobody that can give you a concept of reward and punishment or consequence to your actions. Whatever you do is just what you do. So says Hashem, lo tov heyos adam levado means there's no opportunity for a person to even do good if all he's doing is things by himself. You do this, okay, fine. You do that, it's fine. But once you introduce another person into the equation, so what you do is something good for them or it's something bad for them. So on the one hand, it introduces the possibility of doing something bad. You don't take out the trash. You don't clean up after yourself. You don't wash the dishes properly. So those are bad things. But it also introduces the opportunity to do good. Perhaps we can say that that's what it means, aselo ezer kenegdo. It is a help to the person by having an opposition, by having someone that you have to work with, that's opposite you, that you have to compromise with, that comes with consequences if you don't do the right thing, but rewards if you do the right thing. And that's presumably what we say here. When we have four different kids, we have the opposition. We have something that we have to work with. We have to create a chanoch lanar al pi darko. We have to struggle with how it is that I'm going to accommodate this child or that child, even if they're all different. And I think that's what it means. Keneged arba banim. That Hashem is telling us, I'm giving you an opposition for your own good. If you look back at the pasuk, aselo ezer kenegdo. It doesn't say it's good for the woman. It says it's an ezer for the man. It's good for the man when he has an opposition. Because as much as you can do things by yourself, if you don't have somebody else to compromise with, you're not going to become a better person yourself. You're not going to have to work on yourself at all. You just do whatever you want. By the fact that you have somebody else to work with, it makes you have to put your own desires aside. It makes you have to be stronger and accommodate for another person, even at your own detriment. When there's that tension, you have to push away that tension. And presumably that's what it means. Keneged arba banim means that the questions that the children ask are not just for the children to know, but they're for us to become better people. That we have to accommodate our children. We have to become better through that opposition, through that nigud, through that keneged, we become better. And that's presumably why the Rambam tells us in his Mishnah Torah that even if you have no children around, even if you have nobody else, even if you're sitting at the Seder with just yourself or with a limited number of people like maybe we have this year, you still have to ask all these questions. You still ask the Manishtana. You still go through all the questions of the four sons. Because the purpose of the questions and the opposition is not only for the people you're talking to. Speaking of sons, but it's also for yourself. To have to work around and to accommodate other people when you have to answer the questions. Right? Which son are you? Are you the Chacham? The Rasha? The Tam? Or the Enyo de Elishol? Most people think, many people think, and if you look at any of the illustrated Haggadahs, you'll find that the Eino Yode Lishol is a child who doesn't know how to ask something. I am a firm believer in the fact that if that was the case, the Haggadah would have written, Eino yodea ech lishol. He doesn't know how to ask. It doesn't say, Eino yodea ech lishol. It says, Eino yodea lishol. He does not know to ask. And this, I think, is a very important idea. Skipping ahead a little bit, we have three other people to talk about first. But I think this is a very important idea because oftentimes we think that if something doesn't make sense, we'll just ask a question. But before you ask a question, you have to know something a little bit. Right? And I think when we say, Eino yodea lishol, what it means is that this person has the humility to recognize he doesn't even know enough that he can ask a question about something. Right? In order to ask about something, you have to know about something. Imagine a person takes a whole course in Spanish. Right? He goes through the whole course and he gets straight A's. And all of a sudden he goes to Mexico and he hears people talking in Spanish. He says, wait a second, you don't know Spanish. I don't understand a word you're saying. You're not making any sense to me. That means that you don't know Spanish. Why are you saying this and not saying that? And he asks all these questions, interrogating these people. It makes no sense. Because for him, he took one simple, surface level understanding of Spanish, and all of a sudden he thinks he knows everything, that he can challenge everybody else. In order to really ask questions, you have to recognize maybe you don't know everything. And that's the Eino yodea lishol. He doesn't know enough to ask. He's the humble person who says, maybe I don't know enough to even challenge what I see in front of me. That's one possible explanation of the Eino yodea lishol. But let's go back a little bit to the Chacham. So the Chacham, Maha'edos v'achukim v'ha'mishpatim, actually not going to focus too much on this, but the Chacham includes within him, within his question, the chukim, which is a cardinal error, obviously, because chukim are not something we're trying to understand. And that's why we say, Ein maftir nachar pesach afikomin, once you have something, don't try to do more. Once you have a chok, you don't try to ask more questions about it. So that's one small nuance in the Chacham. The Rasha is what everybody loves to talk about. Everyone loves to talk about the Rasha because he teaches us what not to be. And everybody, for one reason or another, I talked about this yesterday also, has a propensity to criticize instead of build other people up. So people like to criticize the Rasha. So what does the Rasha say? Ma ha'avodah hazos lachem. What's interesting about the questions of the four sons is that they're all written in the Torah. Right? These questions, well, I guess the three questions, because the Eino yodea lishol doesn't ask one, but the questions that these sons have are all written in the Torah. So who's to say that one question is for one child versus another child? You know, when the Torah introduces it, it doesn't say, ki ish'alcha ha-chacham bincha le'mor. It doesn't say when your wise son asks this. Never says that. It just says, Ki Shacha bin Chalimor, Mahaidus Achukum Ashvatim. It introduces when your son asks. So how does the Baal HaHagada, how does the one whoever wrote it, we don't know who wrote it exactly, but how does he know that this question, Maha Avodah Azos Lachem, is the Rasha's question? Right? Even the Tam asks a very similar question, Maha Avodah Azos. Right? So how do we know that the Rasha is the one that asks? So we have the drasha afterwards, that Lachem, below lo, etc. But you can understand a much simpler way. If you look closely at the psukim, so the psukim are throughout the Torah. But one of the psukim the two psukim have the same introduction. The pasuk says, "Ki ish alcha bin chalemor," when your child asks you a question. But that's not the introduction to the question of the Rasha. The question of the Rasha doesn't say Ki Yish'alcha, but rather it says V'haya k'yomru aleichem Ma avodah zos lachem. When they say to you, not when they ask to you. Even though the words are phrased in question form, the introduction to the question is V'haya k'yomru aleichem. That's the pasuk in Shmos Yudbez Tes Zayin 12:16. It says V'haya k'yomru. It is when they will ask you. And presumably that was the indication to the Baal Haggadah, the author of the Haggadah, to tell him that this is not a real question. That this person, whoever is saying, Maha Avodah Azos Lachem, who's ever asking that question, is not really asking it. Because the Pasuk doesn't say, Ki Yish'alcha, or Ki Sha'alu. Rather it says, V'haya Ki Yomru, when they say the following. And we all know that if a person asks a question but doesn't want to know the answer, So that person is not really asking it for the purposes of inquiring, right? He's not asking it because he's kind or because he really wants to know. The Rasha is asking a question in order to bother us. He's asking a question in order to nag us and to just challenge what we're doing. He doesn't really want an answer. And that's why in the answer, we don't actually say anything. You hit him and you say to him, you don't answer him, you say to him, we don't answer him. We just state a matter of fact. If you would have been in Mitzrayim, you would not have been saved. So that's the Rasha. That's how the Baal HaGadah knew it wasn't a real question, because it wasn't introduced by the word ki ish'al. It wasn't introduced by a question. It was introduced by saying. And how many people, unfortunately, do we know that when they challenge us and ask us questions, it doesn't matter what we're going to answer them, they still won't take the answer. They still won't accept whatever we're saying. It's because they're really trying to ask in order to challenge, not in order to know. That's how the Baal HaGadah knew the Rasha's question. If we take it a little further for the Rasha, because as we know, he's the favorite one everyone likes to pick on, because nobody is the Rasha. Baruch Hashem, we can't assume anyone's a Rasha. But the Rasha said that we say by the Rasha, he is kafar bi'ikar. How is he kafar bi'ikar? What is the essence that he's blaspheming, or that he is heretical? What's the heresy of the Rasha? So one could say, presumably, that the Rasha's problem is, as we talk to him, as he says, ma'avodazos lachem, lachem lo lo. Meaning, it's not that he has a problem with the avoda. He knows what the avoda is. He doesn't say like the Tam. As I said before, the language is similar, but it's a very different question. He doesn't say maha avoda hazos. He doesn't say what is this, what is all this service. He says, what is the service to you? Meaning, the Rasha's problem is not what the service is. He already knows what the service is. He is well, you know, educated. He went through Jewish day school. Maybe he went to yeshiva. He knows what the avoda is. The problem for him is that it doesn't mean anything. Mav avoda azos, this service that I know, what does it mean to you? It's not meaningful to me. Lachem v'lo, I don't care for it. And as we know, the basis of Judaism, when we got to Har Sinai and we accepted the Torah, what were the words that we used? Before we're nishma, we say naaseh. Even if we don't understand, we're still going to do it. We're still going to commit ourselves to do the mitzvahs even before we understand them. Even before it's comfortable for us. So the Rasha says, ma'avod azos lachem. I know what the service is. It just doesn't mean anything to me. It's not meaningful. It doesn't make sense to me. And therefore, I'm not going to do it. When it comes to Jewish people and the people that the basis of the Torah, the basis is first Naaseh v'Nishma. Even if we don't know, even if our answer to the Rasha is it's not anything particularly meaningful to us, Ma'avodazos lachem, I'm not really sure yet. Even if that was the case, we would still do the avoda, even if it doesn't mean anything. But for the Rasha, if he doesn't understand it, if he doesn't find it meaningful, then he doesn't do it. And that's the Rasha's problem. And that's the kafar bi'ikar. Because as we know, Naaseh v'Nishma is of the greatest of importance when it comes to Avodas Hashem. That's the ikar of Judaism. That's the essence of accepting the Torah, is to recognize that even if I don't appreciate something fully, even if I can't relate to it, even if I don't understand all the ins and outs and the meanings behind it, I'm still going to do it. That's the Naaseh, even before the Nishma. That's the kafar bi'ikar of the Rasha. And then we answer ve'af ata hakeas shinav. We blunt his teeth. What kind of response is that to a person who's just trying to figure out the meaning? What does that mean, blunt his teeth? So I heard a fascinating understanding once from Rav Moshe Sternbach. Rav Moshe Sternbach explains that what is the Rasha's point in asking this question? He says the Rasha wants to know everything right away. He wants to know, tell me what to do. Ma'avod azos, all of this. Just tell me what it is. What does it mean to you? Let me get on, and then I'll do it. So our answer to him is, you know, in order to really understand the avoda, you have to understand everything. You have to understand the background of Yosef. You have to understand why Hashem gives us the mitzvot. You have to understand a lot of things to truly appreciate what it is that we're doing here at the Seder. The Rasha doesn't want to know that. This is sort of like, as we said in Daf Yomi 2 days ago, the ger, the convert that wants to know everything in one bit. So Hillel gives him a way to understand it a little bit, but Shammai throws him out. You can't understand everything all at once. You have to learn bit by bit, the Aleph Beis. And the Rashi doesn't want that. He wants it in one fell swoop. Give me all of it. Ma havodah azos lachem. Just tell me all of it. Nothing specific like the Chacham. Our response to him is that clearly you're trying to swallow Judaism whole. And if you're trying to swallow it whole without chewing it slowly and meticulously and deliberately, so then you don't need your teeth. You don't need the teeth because you're trying to swallow it whole, and therefore in response, we blunt his teeth as if to say, you're clearly not using them properly, and that's why we're punishing you in this way. Just an interesting idea from Moshe Dornbach that that Yiddishkeit and Avodah Azos Lachem is not supposed to be something we figure out. It's not a light switch that all of a sudden we know everything. But it should be a gradual process where we learn one thing after another, and ultimately we understand what we're supposed to do bit by bit. So what's interesting also about the Sheinu de Elisha, besides what I mentioned before, is that we don't really say what we're saying to him. Meaning like this. The pasuk, the Haggadah says, Sheinu de Elisha at Pesachlo. You open up to him. What does it mean, you open up to him? So the Haggadah says, Shene'emar, as it says. What does it mean, as it says? So one could say, V'higad ha'levin chaviyam hu'le'emor, you should tell over to your son, as opposed to answer to your son. But one could say, the Rav Moshe of Kobrin, Hasidish Rebbe, said that at Pesachlo is not referring to, it's not referring to us. The Haggadah is not telling us to open up to him, but rather what it's saying is, at Pesachlo, we say to Hashem, open up his heart. Open up his ability to understand. Shenamar v'gadol v'chuyam ulemor ba'avor zeh Hashem li b'seisim Mitzrayim. What does that mean? Ba'avor zeh Hashem li b'seisim Mitzrayim. For this, for having the seder, for understanding all the mitzvos of the seder and all the understanding the mitzvos of that are correlated with the Yetzias Mitzrayim, to do all those mitzvos, Hashem took me out. Meaning, at the moment He took me out, I wasn't doing any of the mitzvos. It's only afterwards that I did all the mitzvos. So says Rav Moshe of Kobrin, when it says, at Pesachlo, we say to Hashem, just like you took us out of Egypt, even though we didn't know how to do any of the mitzvos yet, so to this Enio de Elisho, at Pesachlo, open up his heart, redeem him in his own way, so that later on he could also do the mitzvos once he figures them out. And that's what presumably we're saying in this drasha of at Pesachlo, ba'avor zeh asa Hashem li b'tzeis Mitzrayim. Running out of time here. Let's just do a few more that are scattered throughout. Unfortunately, some of my favorite drasha, unfortunately for you, some of my favorite drashas are all in the psukim. The main part of Magid, despite the fact that we love the questions and we love the stories and we love all the main part of Magid is really the drashas. That's the part that people like to skip over. But for me, I love the drashas of the drashas. Figuring out why is this concept represented by this pasuk? What is the drasha meant to explain? So I have a lot of stuff on that, but you know, we don't have time and it's also a little too in-depth. But I will start with this. Mitzchila ovdei avodah zarah ha'avosenu, that we were once idol worshippers. How are we idol worshippers? Because of Lavan or Avram, and then in Lavan's house. So if you skip to Lavan, so it says Arami Ovid Avi, that he tried to wipe us out, or he tried to destroy the Jewish people. Excuse me. So first of all, how did he try? How is it that Arami Ovid Avi Vayered Mitzrayma? What are those two things? What do those two things have to do with each other? How is it that Lavan caused us to go to Egypt? So simply put, because Lavan is the one that mixed Leah and Rachel. And it's because of the fact that Yaakov married Leah that ultimately the brothers were jealous of Yosef, because Yosef was coveted by the fact that he was Rachel, and the other kids that weren't from Rachel were jealous, and therefore they sold him down to Egypt. Ultimately, the whole point that we got to Egypt was really because of Lavan, because he swapped the women, Leah and Rachel, that caused them to get to Egypt. So that's just the connection in that pasuk. That's how you understand that pasuk. But a fan favorite. Here's a fan favorite towards the end of our learning over here. Who was Lavan? So, let's back up for a second. The Gemara Nida tells us a very interesting concept, which is presumably not literal and not scientific, and it's also not representative of everybody. So before you take offense to what I'm about to say, first, it's a Gemara, and it's not to be taken literally, it's taken to be sort of a representative of a generalized statement. The Gemara says that there are three partners in creating a person. There's the man, there's the woman, and then there's Hashem. Hashem gives the ruach, he gives the nefesh, he gives the batteries, right? He makes everything work. Then there's the woman. The Gemara says the woman gives everything that's red, everything that's colored. So the blood and the flesh and the color of the eye, that's the woman gives all the odem. She gives all the redness, all the coloring. The man, however, gives all the white. The man gives the white, that's the bones, that's the sinews, that's the white of the eye, that's the teeth. Okay, it's an interesting Gemara, obviously not very scientific, and also not something we can talk about right now. But what is the difference between red, the blood of the body, and the white of the body? So one could say, and this is all from the Shla, the Shnei Luchos HaBris. The Shla explains that white represents the white matter in your brain. The white represents the intellectual side of a person. And as men who are unfortunately not so sensitive sometimes, not so emotionally in tune, they're much more cerebral. Men are focused more on how to get things done, the functionality of things. They don't always have the right emotional sensitivities. Now, obviously, we're not going to get into who's who and whatever. But obviously, there are exceptions. But on the whole, men have that stigma, even today, that men are less emotional and more functional and cerebral. The women, on the other hand, are much more passionate about things. They're emotional. That's the red. That's the blood of a person. The blood boils, right? The blood is something that represents how charged your body is. The passion of your body. That's red. So we have, on the one hand, men represented by white, women represented by red. Who are the main adversaries of the Jewish people? On the one hand, if you think back to Yaakov Avinu, he has two adversaries. On the one hand, he has Esav. We know Esav was named Edom. He was named Red. What was Esav's modus operandi in trying to attack Yaakov? It was his passion. He was a passionate, aggressive warrior. His blood boiled at the thought that Yaakov could steal the Bechorah from him. Right? Esav is that aggressive, emotional, passionate warrior. Who was the other foe, the other enemy of Yaakov Avinu? Lavan. Lavan, as we know, means white. What did Lavan do? Lavan tried to trick Yaakov. He switched the women. He tried to trick him into staying even longer than the 14 years he was already there for. Lavan was constantly trying to trick Yaakov into doing different things. So we see again, Lavan is the white. It's representative of cerebral, intellectual aspects of things, and the red is representative of the passion and the aggression. How many forefathers do we have? Three. How many foremothers do we have? Four. What mitzvos do we have that are three and four at the Seder? We have three matzahs. If you think about matzahs, the three forefathers, the men of the Jewish people's dynasty, the three matzahs are not something that when you eat them, you feel anything particularly. Sometimes it feels like that's the maror, but if you have an okay piece of matzah, so it's not so bad. The way that you connect to the matzah is by understanding why we're eating matzah. It's an intellectual connection. We think about it. On the other hand, we have something else at the Seder that we all consume, and that's the four cups of wine. The four cups of wine, the halacha tells us, have to be red. They have to be red, representative of the blood. We have four mothers. Four mothers. And when we drink the wine, and it's something that we feel. It gets our blood moving. It's a passionate, it's something that's a natural feeling emotion. We don't have to think about what the wine is. So when we think about the Seder, what we have are two aspects. We have, on the one hand, we have the knowledge aspect, we have the intellectual aspect, that's represented by the man, the forefathers, three matzahs, which are white, represent the intellectual aspect of the Seder. That's Lavan. On the other hand, we have the four cups of wine, which are red. The four foremothers, which are red, which represent the emotional aspect of the Seder, as we saw earlier on. Even if Kulan Chachamim, Kulam Nevodim, Kulam Zakena, we all know exactly what we're supposed to, what the story is all about. We all know all these things intellectually. Mitzvah Lasaper. It's still a mitzvah to say the emotional aspect, to get connected to it, to feel it. That's the difference between Lavan and Esav. That's the difference between the matzahs and the Dalet Kosos. That's the difference between 3 and 4. And that's a theme that runs throughout the Seder. Just to finish off here, we have a famous question from Dayenu. I believe David Barth asked this question and will be answering it in his own way, but I did not get to see it. I don't think he gave this answer. I looked at it very briefly. But the question is, that he brought us to Har Sinai, right? Hashem, I don't know if that's the word, Sherekaravanu Hamakom, I don't exactly remember if it's Har Sinai, but then we say, it would have been enough that right, Sherekaravanu Hamakom Har Sinai, is that the word?
Sherekaravanu
Lifnei Har Sinai, right. Shekarvanu Amakum Lifnei Har Sinai, but he didn't give us a Torah. That would have been enough. It would have been enough to get to the mountain and to not get the Torah. That's what it sounds like. How could it be? How could it be that Hashem is still worthwhile to praise Hashem if he doesn't give us a Torah? What do we get for just being on a mountain? So there are tons of answers to this question. You can answer it on the side that it's still Ki'ishachad Belevachad, it brought us together, even if we didn't get the Torah. You can answer it that it's like, and the Gemara implies like this in Shabbos, we'll see it later on, Daf Yomi, that there is an aura about Har Sinai that was transformative regardless of getting the Torah or not. That they say like a person who goes into a perfumery, I don't know if that's a word, is that David's answer? I don't remember. You go in, and even if you don't buy anything, you still smell like it when you walk out. That's probably one of the more popular answers. But I saw one answer from the Maharal which I thought was so beautiful. The Dayenu is not trying to tell us. It's not trying to tell us that when we would get to Har Sinai, Hashem wouldn't give us the Torah. When it says Keravanu Hamakom Lifnei Har Sinai, what it means is he's giving us the Torah. But there are different types of giving of the Torah. You could come to the Torah and you can get it as a strict book of laws which have nothing to do with the people. But he says there's another stage, which is the next part, that it's Nasan Lanu Es HaTorah. Hashem gave the Torah to us. It doesn't just say Shenasan Torah. It's Shenasan Lanu Torah. That Hashem specifically tailored the Torah to be meaningful for us. That when we do the mitzvos, when we follow the Torah, it's going to be tailored to us to the extent that we can benefit from it as people. We can develop. He gave us the Torah. Shenasan Lanu Es HaTorah. It was tailored specifically to us. Lastly, but surely not least, just to finish us off here, we have the statement of Rabbi Gamliel. Rabbi Gamliel says that in order to be Yotze the Chiyuv of the Seder, I think Gil Stevens has a piece on this, very quick piece, but in order to be Yotze the Seder, you need three things. You need Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. There's a big problem with this statement, and that is that Pesach, Matzah come after Maror. What is Maror? Maror represents the bitterness of Egypt. The bitterness of the slavery. When did Pesach come? We had the Karban Pesach with the matzah after the slavery. Hashem already did all the makos. We hadn't been working for months already. So why is it that the order is Pesach, matzah, and then maror? Maror should be first. It should be maror, Pesach, and matzah. Because that's the order that it actually happened in. And different, many people explain, I saw this originally from Rabbi Eli Mansour, Sephardi rabbi, very, very popular online. He says that in order to appreciate the Maror, first you have to have the Pesach. That sometimes we have difficulties in life and we do not understand why we have them. And if we were to try to appreciate the Maror before we got to the Pesach, so we wouldn't really understand it. It's only once you go through Pesach, you have the Matzah, you understand the Jewish people came out of Egypt, that you realize that the Maror was a predecessor, was a necessary condition, a precondition to that Geula. That only once you actually get out of Egypt can you appreciate what happened inside of Egypt. And that's why it says at first, Pesach, Matzah, and Maror, you appreciate the Geula aspects. You appreciate the Pesach, you appreciate the Matzah, and then afterwards you can appreciate the Maror. I can't tell you what exactly our appreciation is supposed to be right now for the fact that we're all stuck here by ourselves, in our families, in our homes, without our usual davening, without our usual, kakeli, without our usual yisker service. I can't tell you why we don't have that this year. It's a very bitter experience, and for many people, it's a very difficult experience. But I can tell you that hopefully later on, when we, Yemirat Hashem, soon come back together, and we enjoy the presence of each other, we'll appreciate better maybe the camaraderie that we've always had, we'll appreciate better the shul that we've always had, we'll appreciate better the kiddushes and the davenings. Maybe after that, we'll realize that this whole process was in order for us to appreciate each other better. I can't tell you, but hopefully after the process, when we have the salvation, hopefully soon, where Hashem brings us back together, that hopefully then we can appreciate why exactly Hashem is putting us through this. I can't tell you exactly why right now. I mentioned it in the Shabbos HaGadol Drasha, but Emir Hashem soon will have that redemption, we'll have that salvation, just like the Jewish people had the Geula from Egypt, and we will hopefully recognize and appreciate in retrospect what exactly this Maror is for us. But nonetheless, we should make the most of it. We should make the most of the Seder that we have. Take some of these ideas. Take your own ideas. Send me some ideas so I can send it to other people. And Mirat Hashem will make the most of our situation now. Just like the Jewish people had in Egypt, their first Seder was alone in their own homes, not with anyone else. No mixing, no other people. So too we should make the most of our Seder this year, like the Jews did in Egypt. And hopefully everyone has a Chag Kasher, Ubari V'Sameach, a kosher, healthy and enjoyable holiday. I hope this gave you a little bit more to talk about. So, Mirat Hashem, we'll all go into the holiday with a renewed sense of meaning for some of the Haggadah. Obviously, a lot more to say, but we don't have all day. Some people have things to do. L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim. Chag Sameach to everyone. We'll send out another email tomorrow, and we're going to have a pre-Pesach, chizuk, as we do for Shabbos. I'll send it out in the bulletin about when the time is and everything. Okay, everyone should be well.